Hi, this is Jennifer, and welcome to the latest episode of Minorities in Publishing, back after a bit of a hiatus since I was on vacation for a bit. You can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. Thank you so much for tuning in this week, and I'm really excited to be speaking with Nyla Magruder, who is the creator of the MFK webcomic, which is the Dwayne McDuffie Award-winning comic for diversity. And also, she has an upcoming picture book coming out called Fox Hunt with Fuel and Friends. So a lot's been going on for Nyla. And thank you so much, Nyla, for connecting via Skype. And just kind of a disclaimer for listeners, if you hear stuff in the background, that's be my neighbors or my neighbor's dog. So Nyla, thank you again for being on. And I wanted to talk to you about MFK in general. But also, it's kind of funny because you and I connected via SCBWI, the Society of Children's Books Writers and Illustrators. And we were both at the LA conference last year. And we kind of connected via social media after that and have maintained in contact. So it's been so great to see everything that's happened with you and, to have been introduced to your wonderful illustrations. So I can kind of consider you a veteran in this instance because you've been consistently working on your craft as a artist of color, writer of color as well, creative artist of color. So it's interesting that with MFK, I believe when you started that, it was before you got your job and you were taking on the endeavor of this long process. Well, not necessarily a long process, but this webcomic with a bigger arc. And then next thing you know, you got a job. So how did that happen?
Right. Well, funny enough, this all started a little over 3 years ago. And at the time, I was unemployed. I just moved out to Los Angeles and I was looking for work, but I hadn't found anything yet. And just to keep my spirits up and to keep me drawing and working on my craft, I decided, you know what? I've had this idea for years. I'm finally going to do it. I'm going to start this webcomic. And the day it started, I got a job.
Yeah, that's kind of how it works, isn't it?
Of course. Yeah, part of the reason I started it was I had all this free time. And so I was going to devote all of it to drawing this comic. And then immediately I get a full-time job. And so I had to scale back and try and manage the two at the same time.
Yeah, and you kind of noted that as well in terms of, because let me kind of go back a little bit, MFK, webcomic specifically.
Yes.
Created a few years ago, and you're on chapter 4, I think?
Yes. Yeah, just started.
That just started, and it was coming out weekly.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of, sub-chapters within the main chapters, and it follows primarily Abby.
Correct.
Who, I don't know if you want to term her as a superhero?
I've heard people call her a superhero. I don't consider her as such just because it really, it doesn't really feel like the traditional Western superhero comic, but I guess, she does have superpowers. So in that sense, yeah, she kind of is a superhero.
And I don't necessarily, I'm looking for proper wording in terms of Jamie, who may not be the sidekick.
Well, I definitely think of him as a sidekick. Yeah, he's a bit of a second banana.
Yeah, he's quirky. He's sweet. He's like the good-natured guy.
Yes. Yeah, he's the heart.
And one of the reasons that you had started, that you mentioned that you started MFK, was because you weren't seeing these types of stories in what was, perhaps we can call it part of the mainstream, in terms of comics, especially something that we talk about on the podcast and in general is the lack of diverse people behind the scenes and diverse creators as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the impetus. impetus, as you had mentioned in interviews, for creating MFK. So what was it that you wanted to see in terms of your own comic?
Gosh, I wanted to see Black characters. You know, I started this idea, like, let's go even further back. I started it when I was just graduated high school, and I was kind of in between high school and college. And I remember, it's been so long, I don't entirely remember, you know, how the story formed or the complete lead up to it, but there were two distinct moments. At the time, I was really into reading shonen manga, so Naruto, One Piece, Shaman King, that sort of thing. And I noticed that, like, they had these kick-ass female characters, but anytime those girls had to go up against the guy, they failed. Like, they were just completely beaten. And so, you know, I just thought it was kind of lame. And I thought, you know, I'd like to read a story that's just like this, but it's about a girl, you know, and the gender roles are kind of balanced. So, you know, the girls aren't worse than the guys. They're equals. And, you know, and then I decided, you know, I'm going to create this comic. I'm actually going to do it. I'm going to have an action story that's about a girl, and she's going to be Black. Because at the time, like, I'd become very aware of my own patterns in my drawing. Like, I was a very active artist. I really hadn't turned on to the idea of going into animation just drawing a comic was, you know, not really a priority back then. But I had noticed that when I create characters, they were often white or light skinned. And I really don't know why I started to analyze this, but I had noticed that pattern, that there was something about the idea of a Black character in a fantasy story or an action story that made me uncomfortable. And, like, you know, I identified that there was something wrong with that. You know, I'm Black. You know, seeing myself shouldn't make me feel weird. And, you know, making this decision was kind of a challenge to myself to fight against that feeling and to normalize it. And, you know, Shonda Rhimes just actually recently, you know, used that term. I wanted to make this a normal thing and, you know, just find a comfort level within, you know, my own storytelling. And still, you know, I wasn't thinking about promoting these issues back then, but I just wanted to, you know, I just wanted to explore my own role in this situation. And so, and that's kind of how it started. And at the time, yeah, you didn't really see very many positive Black roles in comics, and you didn't see them in webcomics either. Like, webcomics were still kind of a new thing, and at the time, you know, I was very aware that this was going to be out of the ordinary, and I was very excited about it. And then I didn't work on the story for a very long time, and when I came back to it and decided, you know, in 2010, I was thinking about it again. It's still, you know, I was looking at webcomics and it was still kind of the case. You know, there still wasn't that much diversity. And, you know, like, it'd been so many years, I was thinking, clearly webcomics have probably, you know, solved this issue. There's probably not a need for a story like this anymore. Like, Avatar the Last Airbender was a huge thing. So I was actually surprised to come back and realize, you know, there still aren't that many brown-skinned protagonists. And so at that point, I was like, all right, I have to do this. I have to give it a shot.
Wow, that's really interesting, because one of my initial questions was if you considered the webcomic world kind of similar to the indie publishing world, because in the indie publishing, you know, a lot of self-published authors, there tend to be more writers of color.
Yeah.
Who are self-publishing their books because then choosing not to go the publishing route because of this, you know, pushback they've received, assumptions, or wanting to have control over their content, knowing the audience better and feeling they can distribute and create product better for the people of color that they're reaching out to who aren't being reached out to the mainstream. So So it's interesting when you say webcomics is actually not that way, or maybe it's starting to slowly become that way.
I think it's becoming that way. I do think that there's a lot more diversity in webcomics, and it kind of reflects indie publishing that way, because there's absolutely no barriers in webcomics. There's no gatekeeper. You know, anyone who can, you know, there's not even a monetary gatekeeper, really. Like, you don't need to pay for web hosting to have a webcomic. You can post on Tumblr. There are so many avenues for getting your work seen online. So, you know, I do think that there are a lot more minority creators in webcomics, and there's a lot more experimentation. There's a lot more variety. But, you know, at the time, and this was about 3 or 4 years ago, and at the time, what I was doing, I still was not seeing a lot of. Like, I'd look at cast lineups, and, you know, kind of the thing I would look for is, if you, like, say on the cover of a comic, if you could only feature the main protagonists, or like two protagonists, who would they be? And, you know, some stories had diverse casts, but still, if you had to pick one or two main characters, they were often, you know, those top two characters were still often white. And so, you know, at the time, I wasn't seeing very many, like, leading dark-skinned characters. I think that's changing now. I'm seeing more of it. But still, I feel like indie publishing and indie comics still reflect the mainstream in a way. There's still, there's not as much homogeny, but there's still a bit of it, you know?
And on the flip side, in terms of the creators of that content, it seems very much so that there aren't a lot of writers of color and illustrators of color in the comic book world. And, you know, we hear, you know, kind of the same name said over and over again, and maybe that is definitely the case, I think, in the book publishing world, is that you hear the Chimamandas and the Juno Diazes, and they're, you know, recently Marvel was talking about, oh, well, we have Jean Luen Yang. And
right.
And everyone refers to Ms. Marvel. Yeah. So people are just referring to the same kind of four or five places or big thing, no, but there is a huge pool of illustrators.
And I'm right.
Just like yourself, because you cross over, you don't just do comics, you do books.
Correct.
You do animation as well. So there is crossover there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and so, you know, people have been talking about that recently, how, you know, the mainstream kind of finds their one representative of the marginalized voice, and that is it. Like, you know, we have that. We have this one already. You know, we're well represented there. But, you know, there are so many artists that just haven't been discovered by the mainstream yet. You know, they haven't seen Agents of the Realm or Star Trip, and these are web comics that, you know, promote diversity. They, you know, these are talented artists who, you know, like, eventually the mainstream is going to see what they've been missing out on. Like, a lot of this diversity that people are gunning for is already there in web comics, and you just have to look. There are so many web comics. There are so many artists that aren't waiting around for publishing to catch on. They've already started their own stories, and they're online.
Or starting Kickstarters.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. Did you hear about the Beyond anthology?
I believe you Tumblr'd that.
Yeah, it's an anthology of queer comics that I think they just passed 50,000 on Kickstarter. Like, they far exceeded their goal, and, you know, it's just further proof that people want these stories.
And it's good that there's a venue for people to go, you know, the Indiegogos, the Kickstarters, to show the proof, and it's a matter also, I think, publishers finding those voices, like you say, but also not going for the niche market, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, you seem popular and we'll take you, but then stopping there.
Exactly.
The continuous kind of blockade is that people are looking for more diverse work, but there's still the quota aspect.
Right, exactly.
Words like the Dwayne McDuffie and seeing Kickstarters and seeing the huge amount of diversity on the social media family, you know, Black Panthers and all those areas of talking about comics and talking about Black characters in comics and queer characters of comics. It's just such a huge problem. It's weird that this hasn't been tapped into.
Yeah, I don't understand. Like, you know, and this, people have said this before. This is a huge market that you could tap into, and we're waiting for the mainstream to tap into it. Like, this is piles of money that you're ignoring, but, and for what? Like, why? And I mean, you know, whatever. It's fine. We're still, you know, we're still doing our own thing. But, and, you know, and I think the comics community needs that, you know, we need our independent publishing. We need a way for like these voices to still be heard without relying on the mainstream. But at the same time, we need the mainstream to catch up too. You know, like, you know, products like Ms. Marvel reach so many people, like, And that's important. You know, the mainstream, Marvel and DC, they already have an established platform that people are watching, that people have access to. And so it's important for, you know, it's important for them to catch up in terms of diversity because they, you know, they have a larger megaphone. And so we need that development, but, you know, a lot of the variety that people are looking for does already exist. You just have to look.
And I would love to see the bridging of this community with the literary community and the graphic novel and comic community, realizing that they are literature. These are all aspects of representing stories.
Yeah, there's, you know, there's just a weird devaluing of art in general for some reason in our society. Like, I hear in Europe it's a lot different. Like, countries like France and England, I think, they really value their comics. They love comic artists. And here, you know, artists really have to fight to be credited for their work, to be paid for their work, you know, and it's something, it's just a problem across the board within the industry. And I don't know how it got that way or how to fix it exactly. But yeah, it's kind of weird. Like, comics are treated as, I guess, children's fare. It's kind of the same thing we deal with animation. Like, everyone views animation as kids, you know, for kids. And it's not really. Like, it's great family entertainment usually, but, you know, animation's really not about the content. It's about the medium. And so there's kind of a wide breadth of content that you can find within animation, not just for kids, but for adults.
Yeah. And also there's, I think, something working with We Need Diverse Books is something we try to focus on is the illustrator aspect as well, not just the writers.
Mm-hmm.
Necessity for diverse illustrators, because right. I feel like that's a very small pool. In terms of recognition, in terms of those who are hired, in terms of those who are supported, I'm not as in the loop in terms of the visual medium as I am in terms of the words themselves, but it's great that SCBWI has things like Illustrator and the Golden Kite and the Tomi DiPola. I would like to see more focus on building up illustrators and visual artists of color specifically.
Yeah, definitely. And I, not to catch any flack here, but there's, you know, within SCBWI, there is definitely more emphasis on writing. Like if you go to the events, and I would too. I would like to see more about illustration, definitely. And I also have noticed that there's very little regarding graphic novels. Like I think that's kind of still a growing industry, but I think it's one that needs to grow. Like, comics is kind of weird because I think it's, you know, it's all kind of assumed to be all ages, like, you know, superhero comics and everything. There, within the comics industry, there really isn't like age designation like there is within children's books. Like in children's books, there's very clearly like the picture book, like the ages 2 to 5 set, and then the middle grade and young adult. And that really doesn't exist in comics. And so then when you have properties like Amulet by Kazu Kibuishi and like, Reina Telgemeier, Smile and Drama and Sisters, you know, those are very clearly like middle grade books. And then YA, we have Nimona, Noelle Stevenson now. And so, There doesn't seem to be as much, I guess, organization there within children's book publishing. And I would like to see a lot more of that, especially, you know, diverse titles. Like, we don't really have many, you know, diverse middle grade and YA graphic novels. And yeah, I would love to see more of that.
Yeah. Graphic novels have also been nominated the past few years for National Book Awards.
Oh, yes.
I would think that recognition in that way. I think the past year, a nonfiction book was a graphic novel. And the year before that, Gene, and he had been nominated before for a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are these stories that can be told visually. But often I'm seeing that, you know, the illustrator is also the writer. So it's that multiple responsibilities of being writer and illustrator, which gives you a bit more control.
Yeah, it definitely gives you more control, but it's very difficult. Like, it's great, but it takes such a long time to just tell a story when you're doing both.
What's really cool about reading MFK as a webcomic is you offer the commentary as your story. You had noticed in the beginning, like, okay, well, I didn't like how I did this, so and I'm playing with panels in this one. And
Yeah, because this is really my first long form comic. I've never done, I've dabbled in comics, but I really wouldn't call it, you know, it's not where I'm proficient. You know, I'm a storyboard artist, and the language between storyboarding and illustrating for comics is very different. And on top of that, like illustrating it on top of writing, it's such a challenge, because one of the great things about collaboration is when you're illustrating for someone else's idea, you're bringing your own perspective to it. You're looking at it with fresh eyes. And so you're going to see possibilities and opportunities that maybe the writer didn't see. But I feel like when you're both the writer and illustrator, you're very inside your own head. And so it's hard to, you know, you don't have that extra perspective there. You just have your one perspective. And so, you know, sometimes I do get very hung up on, you know, how do I know what I want to happen. I don't know how best to communicate it. I don't know how best to visualize it. And so that, you know, sometimes I end up, you know, redrawing panels over and over, or I get into the inking stage and it finally hits me that something in a panel composition has been bugging me, and then I have to go back and fix it before I can continue. And so, and I'm sure like any illustrator has to deal with this, but yeah, like I feel they're definitely, you know, writing and illustrating on the same project brings its own set of complexities. But it's, you know, I love it. I love it still. You know, I love having that control. And, you know, the story relies entirely on me. And so I still value that.
So are you pretty psyched to have an editor for the picture book to have those?
Oh, yes. Yes. Having worked alone for so long, I'm so excited to kind of share the wealth, I guess, you know, just to experience what is it like to work with someone else. Yeah. You know, I'm used to working in animation. I'm used to getting feedback. And so you know, one of the things I loved about art school is how collaborative it was. You know, if you needed help working on a story, you just went to your classmates or you went to your professor. And I kind of missed that. So having never sold a book before, I really don't know what I'm getting myself into, but I'm excited to find out.
Well, talking about school, I'm wondering, do you have any mentors, or as you studied and further pursued illustration, writing, and animation? Some guests on the show previously have mentioned the lack of mentors.
Mm-hmm.
Just people being absent, especially finding other people of color
as right.
to their area of writing, whether it's being in publishing as a publishing professional. I mean, did you find that there was anyone there to help guide you in terms of the workforce, in terms of what your voice, so to speak, is, or your specific style in terms of animation?
I'm going to try and answer this, get all my thoughts out without forgetting your core question here. I will say that I feel very lucky in a lot of ways because animation is not diverse at all. Like, this conversation that's going on in publishing and in comics, we haven't even begun to start it. I wonder what that would even look like animation discussing diversity. I know Black women who are pursuing storyboarding or pursuing, you know, art and animation, but I don't have any colleagues. Like, I'm the only Black person at my studio. I was the only Black woman I knew when I was interning at a much larger studio. And that's kind of been my experience living out here. Like, there just aren't that many of us. And so in terms of that sort of role model, I have none. I'm kind of, in many ways, I feel like I'm just like shooting in the dark. You know, I'm figuring things out as I go because I really don't have a structure to follow. That said, when I was, I'll identify two people. You know, when I was in school, I had a professor named Karen who taught our concept development classes. And so that was storyboarding essentially. And weirdly enough, when I was in school, I didn't know anything about storyboarding. And from the sounds of it, it just sounded incredibly boring. And I knew I'd never want to do anything like that. And so it turns out, like, I got into her class in junior year and I was horrible. I didn't know what I was doing and she really pushed me and she, you know, she kind of identified early on that I picked difficult ideas, but she would help me work through them. Like, I would get so frustrated, but she never said, no, that's a bad idea. She always helped me figure it out. And so, you know, in that year, I went from not really understanding what I was doing to suddenly becoming very good at storyboarding. And that led to an internship at Sony Pictures Animation, you know, that following summer. And my mentor there was Jack Hsu. And so we connected. We actually connected at school. He came to hold a workshop there and he got a chance to see my storyboards and he was very excited about me. Like, I hadn't applied for the internship at the time, but he recommended me. And so I had the opportunity to go to Sony for the summer. And that's kind of where my love of storyboarding solidified. Like, Jack was very, you know, he was very supportive of me. He kind of took me under his wing, and I don't feel like I was the best intern because I was just starstruck in a way, I guess. Like, I was just completely out of it. And it was my first time in Los Angeles, and it was very lonely, and it was kind of a stressful summer. But he was very, very attentive of me, and very, you know, like, I didn't want to bug him really, because he was very busy on this project that we're working on. But, you know, he would call me on weekends sometimes just to, you know, just to talk about the work and talk about my development. And, you know, he really watched out for me while I was there, and even afterward, and even now. Like, I've been meaning to call him, actually. Like, I feel so bad that I haven't talked to him in so long, but I want to call him. But yeah, like, you know, there were many opportunities for me to kind of just lose my interest in this profession, because it's very hard. But, you know, those two people helped, you know, just help me keep the spark alive, I guess. And so, like, I never, you know, I was never searching for a mentor. I didn't, at the time, I didn't know a mentor was something that you should aspire to find. So I was very lucky to find them.
And that's kind of how mentorships, it seems, work.
Yeah. Yeah. And, like, you know, I've heard, you know, a lot of people talk about how to find your mentor. And, you know, I've read some blogs of people that say you really shouldn't, you know, seek out a mentor. You know, you don't go up to a person and say, will you be my mentor? You just kind of let this naturally develop. And so I guess that's kind of why I've never really looked for one. You know, if I happen to find one and identify one that's already in my life, then great. But, you know, I think those, for me, those two people were enough at the time. And now, I don't know, I haven't, you know, I really haven't developed any close relationships like that, like mentor and student. Like, I definitely have a lot of peers that I'm close to.
Well, do you feel like that's available in the SCBWI community as well? I think that's something they're seeking to develop in some way.
I think it could be potentially, you know, and I don't think it's a bad idea. The problem with illustrators is we're always constantly busy. So I can see the difficulty there with setting up a program, but, you know, I definitely don't think it's a bad idea. Like, SCBWI LA, I'm not sure about the New York conference, but LA has the Illustrators Showcase contest. And, you know, it has that mentorship program through that. And I hear that's great. Like, I've heard nothing but good things about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, it's only available to 5 illustrators a year. Yeah. So, yeah. Everyone else has to kind of find their own. But, you know, the reason I love SCBWI, especially out here, is there are so many events. You know, there are so many opportunities to network and meet writers and illustrators. And so if you're looking for a mentor, they're certainly out here, I think.
It definitely seems, just like you say, people are busy.
Right.
So, and with illustration, there's just, maybe there's just a bigger road in terms of sharing the work itself.
Right.
I could send a Word document and say, track changes, please, and talk about it.
But right, right.
So much more distinctness to looking at the visual components and giving feedback on that.
Yeah. You know, like, I actually set up a picture book critique group recently, because I'd been a part of writing critique groups and illustration critique groups, but I wanted a picture book group that married both for authors and illustrators. And it was actually really hard to find members. Like, we're a group of 3 people, and it's great. I love it. But when I first put out the call, I figured, oh, people are going to jump on this, and no one really did. but, you know, out here in LA's, location's also an issue because LA County's so big. And so I did get a few people who wanted to participate, but we were too far away from them. And, you know, I don't blame them. It doesn't make sense to drive an hour in the evening for like an hour critique group. But yeah. Yeah, I'm from Maryland. I'm used to everything being compact and close, and it'll take you an hour or two, and that's just to get to another state.
Yeah, to get to the other.
Right.
An animator, illustrator, designer, writer. Have you also found yourself to be one of the few women, let alone people of color in your field?
No.
A multitude of things. You know, it's not like you're a one-trick pony, so to speak. You work on books, you work on animation, you work on different levels of media.
Right. And for me, no. Like, I have no problem finding women. Even at my job, I think the genders are very balanced, but I know that's, you know, that's not the norm necessarily. Like, I hear stories from other people, and I hope you can't hear this cat yowling in the background. Okay, God. She's just standing on my bed and crying. But me personally, I have no difficulty finding other women artists. But I definitely have trouble finding other Black female artists. I don't know very many. That number is growing recently, but, you know, for me personally, it feels weird to say this out loud, but I think, how do I say it? You know, like, racism is kind of first and forefront in my mind because I think I always experience like barriers because of my race first. Like, I feel like, for me personally, feminism is kind of barely an issue because before people recognize me as a woman, they recognize me as a Black person. And so I feel like personally me, you know, I have no trouble finding other women peers in animation or comics or illustration, but to find other Black people, and even harder, other Black women, you know, that's where my difficulty is.
That's something I think I can definitely identify with, and I think many other people can identify with, in terms of when you're a person of color, you feel like that is the first thing people see.
Right.
That there is truth to that, in essence. And in speaking to the range of the entertainment industry, and I include books in entertainment industry, is that there's that, some people call it underlying, latent, you know, what it comes down to is the old boys club, in a way, because, you know.
Definitely.
Something there that is creating this wall where representation is not equal, and the identification default is the majority, not
right.
The minority. And it's weird to, I'm sure, create these materials or help to create these materials that may not cater to an audience that more aligned into terms of how we grew up or how we're represented. Because I know in my industry as well, being a production editor, a lot of times there are books I focus on education of Black children and such, but yeah, you know, a lot of these books aren't going to be sold to African Americans that I'm working on, or Latinos, or people in the LGBTQIA community. So.
Mm-hmm.
Thing to work on that material and know that it's not for me, so to speak.
Right. You know, my mother, this just reminds me, my mother was a teacher. And so I didn't really grow up talking about these issues with her. But once I got older and kind of expressed my own interest in it, that's when she started telling me stories of her experience. And it's very weird, like how it's weird how this manifests, because I do believe, like, you know, there's a reason that when we talk about the old boys club, it's largely white men. You know, it's, you know, the patriarchy and white supremacy, I think, are very intricately linked. But so she would, this is to digress, she would say that there was this book that all of her colleagues in high school hated to teach. And the book was House on Mango Street. And so, like, her white colleagues would come to her and just complain about having to read the books to these kids. And she would say, oh, I'll read it to them. And they would be like, are you sure? Are you sure you want to do it? And she'd be like, yeah. And so she'd read it, and the kids loved it. They ate it up. And so she was kind of like the department volunteer for reading House of Mango Street to their class. But, you know, it's very, you know, it's... And I think it's been observed before, you know, like if you give kids the opportunity, if you give them diversity, they, you know, they will eat it up. But it's adults who really block them from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the comic book world, for me, what got me into comics was Storm.
Mm-hmm.
Storm, you know, Aurora Monroe. There's a woman who's dark-skinned and from Africa, and she can control the weather, and wow! And
then yeah,
jumped right into X-Men. That was my go-to, because to me at the time, and obviously I wasn't as into the underground scene, I was very aware, I was like 13, so I knew what was the big stuff. Yeah, you know, that was the most diverse representation I saw in the mainstream comic world.
Right. Yeah, it's weird. Like growing up in the 90s, I feel like this was not as big a problem as it is now. You know, we had so much television and so much, you know, we had like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. We had Family Matters. You know, we had X-Men. We had so many properties that showed a variety of perspectives. And so, but you come into the 2000s and all of a sudden that falls off dramatically.
And maybe an aspect of the lack of creators. I think it's definitely linked to that, because you had The Cosby Show, Living Single,
mm-hmm.
created about African Americans for African Americans.
Right.
Margaret Cho, she created that, even though there was a lot of external control.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there was just that lack of nurturing of artists to continue to create those things, or if it was a mixture of that lack of mentorship and also a blockade put up. Well, those were the good shows, you know, those were the wholesome shows. Now we just kind of want these Tyler Perry-esque,
right,
you know, cartoon buffoonery type things, or over the top, even with, you know, Latin Americans. It's over the top, you know. It's,
yeah.
Asian Americans, Indian Americans represented are very docile, but the jokes.
Yeah, and that's definitely true. And gosh, like we're seeing a little bit of headway, like Fresh Off the Boat is on now, but it's still not a lot. You very rarely see Asian Americans on TV. And when you do, they're like very stereotypical roles. And it's the same for Latinos. It's the same, definitely the same for Native Americans. Like we're still fighting that battle. Like it's very, you know, it's very odd to turn on the TV and see that entire populations of people are just being ignored. And like, and at the same time, on the flip side, there are so many redheaded protagonists. Like, I don't even know why I started thinking about that recently, but somebody pointed out, like, there are just so many redheads. And I swear I've not encountered as many redheads in real life as I see in books and television.
Yes.
And
I remember an agent, I see a lot of people with green eyes and red hair in books, especially YA books. And because percentage-wise, they're the least, you don't see people with green eyes and red hair. But for some reason, like you said, you see them pop up in YA books especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because redheads are so feisty and sassy. But yeah, if we can have that many redheads in popular media, there's no reason that we can't have more black people, more Latinos, more Asians, you know, just like everything. And like, what are we missing? You know, somebody else described it, you know, the people who push back against this act like we're trying to take slices of their pie. But what we're really saying is here, have a whole bunch of other pies. You know, let's just have a table of pies. I grew up understanding that sometimes talking to a person is a lot like talking to a brick wall. And I just don't have any interest or energy in talking to brick walls. Like if I, you know, I really value the people who have these arguments and these debates online regarding diversity. You know, they're troopers. You know, they go right in and I cannot do it. Like, I just do not have the energy to, you know, talk at somebody to try and sway the opinion of someone who's clearly just so, you know, so in their head about this, you know. Like, I kind of, my strategy the last few years has just been keep my head down and keep working. You know, they're not going to stop me. So, yeah, like, and they're not going to stop this tidal wave. Like, the tide's already turning. And that's, I'm so glad for the Dwayne McDuffie Award, and I'm so glad for We Need Diverse Books, because, like, this is, you know, this is going to be an ongoing conversation. Like, I feel like in the past, this conversation was happening, but it was getting ignored. And, you know, this pushback is kind of proof that the conversation has gained momentum and it's so much harder to ignore now. So, like, I think, you know, I think that's also why I'm very complacent about it, because, you know, this is kind of a good thing. They're scared. And, you know, and that's because we're gaining a larger voice.
And also encouraging artists. I think that's...
Yeah.
I want to encourage artists, but also encourage people to come into the industry and to...
Yeah.
To create, to acquire, to promote, to figure out how to help lift those voices. Because we need those people like yourself and others to be on the other side as well. Because
it's right.
Getting diverse. If you don't have that diverse editor who can help you make this story better because there's an understanding,
mm-hmm.
that you as a black woman know that what it is like to be a black woman universally, because there's no universal truth to being African American.
Totally. Yeah.
You know, there's this, I was talking to a author who's going to be on soon about the fact that she was just trusted to know everything about black.
Yeah.
Editor was white and obviously was not from a diverse world. So it's kind of like, well, that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And it's not fair. It's just not fair to the artist.
Totally.
You're going to hear it once the work is up.
Yeah. Like, there's so much, I feel like, you know, marginalized voices, when they do show their perspective, like they're always kind of pushed to the front for critique. Like, if you don't do it perfectly, then, you know, people are going to come with their pitchforks, and that's not fair. You know, we don't do that to every creator. We definitely shouldn't, you know, put the pressure on every minority to reflect, you know, the whole population.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but, you know, that I'm so thankful for the internet, because I don't know about you, because I didn't understand publishing at all when I was in high school. I didn't know that it was a career option. I didn't understand that about animation either. And so like kids these days are so lucky because they just have to like, you know, type a few letters and they can research anything. You know, it's so much easier to find out about these industries and to, you know, find creators who are involved in these industries and, you know, to find role models. You know, back to what we were saying, finding mentors, you know, the internet makes communication so much easier.
Yeah, because I didn't know publishing was a thing until I was in college.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, I guess I'll do that for a career. I'm still in it, so thankful for that.
Yeah.
Going back to MFK, it was something you mentioned, you sold print copies at WonderCon this past weekend.
Yep.
So are you thinking, I mean, when you created MFK, did you ever think that it would be something you want to have in print form, or were you that far into the future?
I thought it'd be nice, but it wasn't a priority. Like, I knew I wanted it as a webcomic first. I knew I wanted the freedom and the flexibility to kind of figure it out, to do what I wanted with it, because, you know, I'd never really worked on a story like this before, and I knew I was going in kind of with no editor or, you know, no professional backing, I guess. So I just wanted that freedom to make mistakes and let it exist as, you know, as it was without feeling bad about it as a first project, you know? And so I think most webcomic creators go in, you know, thinking that, you know, kind of wanting to become a popular webcomic. And so I thought that would be nice, but I'd never really expected it to get this far. You know, 3 years down the road, I kind of thought I'd probably burn out by now. You know, I'm 3 years and 120 some pages in. And so, yeah, just, I never expected to win an award for it. And so this is all new territory for me. Like, I'm suddenly thinking about things that I never had to think about before. But I did print an issue last year, and that was mainly because I knew that there was a market at conventions that I was not tapping into. Like, you know, some people just don't read comics online, and so I wanted to just see if I could build a slightly larger audience. You know, I just tried it as an experiment.
So do you, and maybe this is a touchy subject, do you end of MFK, like, do you know where it ends, or it's a continuous journey at the moment?
I know where it ends.
Oh, really?
I don't necessarily know if I'll get there, but I definitely have an endpoint in mind. But it's years down the road, so I don't think about it too much.
So that's a good heads up for me. It's like, it's not anytime soon, folks.
Yeah, no, it's definitely going to be a journey.
Well, thank you so much again, Nyla, for being on the podcast. And your insight, especially from the illustrator perspective, because I think that's really important. And I think it's something that's not as tapped into in terms of when people think publishing, people don't always think the art and the visual media. And it's essential.
It's essential
from the cover to whether you do have illustrations in the work or not. And comic books, I feel like, are their literature and they're part of this world. And I'd love to see publishing and comic books join forces.
Yeah, funny enough, I was actually talking with an agent about that very recently. Yeah, there's so much overlap between children's book publishing specifically and comics, and there's really no reason that we don't get together and have a conversation.
We Need Diverse Books is trying to get more into the comic book. There are some of us who are comic book nerds, but it is
good.
Hard to get, because there's so much, you know.
There is.
Conferences, and there's so many comics, and there's so much. But you know, it's not a matter of it being impossible, it's a matter of follow through. So
yes,
hopefully that will be taken into account, and you'll see a lot more crossover, because I mean, if we're seeing like movie trailers and freaking Comic-Con in LA, there's no reason you can't see publishers.
Yeah, I think we're all entering very new territory, and so we're still figuring out how things work. We're still figuring out terminology, and so it's exciting. It's cool.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm excited to see the journey of MFK and your book, your picture book with Fuel and Friends. And many congrats on all your success. And just
thank you.
I think people just need to see that people are doing it, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're making like 18 figures, you know, but
yeah,
being recognized for that work, and it's just so important.
Yeah, definitely. Like there have been many points when I thought about throwing in the towel and going back home, but there's something Neil deGrasse Tyson said, and it was about the importance of just being present. And so, you know, I always think about that when I get frustrated, that, you know, we need, you know, I'm part of that. I'm part of, you know, that being present. You know, we need visible Black artists in this community. And so, you know, I have a responsibility there, so I'm still here, still work.
And you're being recognized, so that's helpful.
Yeah.
So thank you for MFK. I'm enjoying it.
Oh, thank you. Oh God, it thrills me anytime anyone says they like this story, because I'm just always.
It's like a confrontational Abby can be too. Going to the bathroom, is that okay?
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
And if you want to keep in touch or follow Nyla, feel free to follow her on Twitter at Nylaffle. That's NILAFFLE. Or on her website at nylamagruder.com. NILAMAGRUDER.com. The next guest on the podcast will be authors Zeta Elliott and Renee Watson, and I'm very excited, as I say every episode, to have them on to talk about activism and being writers, and they're educators as well, not just artists, and they talk to students and also emerging writers. So I know that'll be such a great episode. So thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Thanks, and take care.